Hour. Philippians chapter 2 is where we'll be. Philippians 2. And we're going to look at the latter half, really the latter two-thirds of that chapter, I guess. But all right, what did, on Wednesday evening, we looked at the first few verses of this chapter, and what does Paul discuss there in verses 1 through 11 of chapter 2? Okay, all right. The mind, he encourages the Philippians to have the mind of Christ. Starts out by talking about them being united in mind with one another, not doing anything from selfishness or empty conceit, all those things, verses 1 to 4. Have this mind in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, starts in verse 5. And he talks about what did the mind of Christ cause him to do? Okay. To empty himself, it caused him to rather than regarding his status as God as something to be used for his own benefit, he emptied himself, took on the form of a bondservant, was made in the likeness of men. All those things Paul talks about, and humbled himself to the point of death, even death on a cross. That's the ultimate example, Paul says, of this mind that we need to have toward one another. That's the ultimate example of verse 4. Do not merely look out for your own interests, but also for the interests of others, for the things of others. Building on that, Paul says, verse 12, so then, and remember we talked about this Wednesday. When you see the word therefore, you have to stop. Okay, well, he's building on something he said previously. And a lot of times when he says, so then, he's also building on something logically that he talked about previously. So then, my beloved brethren, and what he's going to say is, here's what Jesus has done for you. Now here's what you need to do in response to that. So let's look at the first part of this text. We're going to talk about it. And just kind of work our way through it. So then, is verse 12. So then, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your salvation in fear and trembling, for it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for His good pleasure. Do all things without grumbling or disputing, so that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I will have reason to glory, because I did not run in vain or toil in vain. But even if I am being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. You too, I urge you, rejoice in the same way and share your joy with me. So, let's look at some of the things Paul says here and just talk about it a little bit. So then, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but also in my... So what does that say so far? I mean, what's Paul's evaluation? Remember, he's writing to this Philippian church some 10 years after it is established. What's his evaluation of their faithfulness up to this point? Just right there in verse 12. Okay? It's been characterized by obedience. They've always obeyed. Not just when I was there, but also when I'm gone, which has been most of the time. Paul wasn't in Philippi all that long. So as you have done that, he says, now much more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about that last expression in verse 12. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Many of our translations have work out your own salvation. Own is kind of supplied by the English translators just to individualize the thrust of the command. And unfortunately, I don't know about you, but this is one of the most misused expressions in all of the New Testament in my experience. As far as the way I've heard people use this latter section of verse 12 in a way that I don't think Paul meant it. And we'll explain in a minute. What is Paul telling them to do? Okay, all right. Okay, all right. They need to obey God and follow His commandments. Paul says they've already done that. They need to keep doing that. They need to continue doing that. Sure, okay. All right. Okay, that's a good cross reference to bring up. 2 Peter chapter 1, for this reason also applying all diligence in your faith, supply moral excellence and your moral excellence knowledge. And Peter builds on all these different things it's kind of like Paul's fruit of the Spirit passage in Galatians 5, very similar in import to that. Okay. Somebody else? Well, that sounds pretty basic. So why do we have trouble with this verse? Go ahead, Mark. All right. Okay. Yeah, I think, I think that's exactly right. That Paul of all people would not be telling us this is something you have to go out and earn for yourself. We don't do that. But Paul is equally adamant that salvation is, as Mark said, we need to look at it as a cooperation between ourselves and God in His plan, and it involves a needful response of obedience on our part. Okay? Okay, and Shane's hit on something that I encounter in the way people approach this, or the way people use the wording of this verse. I'm not even sometimes I'm not even sure where they know where it came from. Work out your own salvation in fear and trembling. First of all, we founder, and I think, yeah, especially in the South, we founder on a couple of those expressions because of the way we use them. When we Southerners talking about working out something, what do we mean? Wayne knows. What do we mean? Sure. I mean, that you can't make it say something else. I think that's right. A lot of times when we talk about working out something, we mean, okay, I've got this thing. I've got to figure it out. I've got to sort it out. I've got, I've got to feel my way toward the conclusion. And really the emphasis is on the word work in this phrase. The way I have heard people, in case you're wondering, the way I have heard people use this passage is they'll quote it to say, well, you got to do your thing and I got to do mine. And you got to figure out what's right for you and I got to figure out what's right for me. You know, and it adopts our modern culture's way of just making absolutely everything relative and entirely individual. Now, Paul is emphasizing individual responsibility here. There's no doubt. You know, again, the emphasis is on the word work. We want to put the emphasis on the word own, which technically isn't even in the Greek text. It's work out your salvation. It's, again, our English translators put the word own in there a lot of times because the emphasis is on my individual responsibility toward God. But that doesn't mean that I get to define for myself what that responsibility is. Who defines that? Say it real loud so everybody listening online, God defines that. I don't. Yes, salvation is very, you know, it's my accountability to God is personal and individual, but the source of truth is not personal and individual with me. Ryan, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm going to work it out with God. We're going to work on a plan for me and Him, and and that's how I'm going to get to my plan for salvation. And we use that common our current usage of that phrase "work out" or "work it out" to assume that's what Paul meant.
Excellent point. Yeah. In case you didn't hear what Ryan said, okay. Let's say James and I have some kind of problem or disagreement, and we work it out. Okay. We sit down, we compromise, we negotiate, we work out a deal, and that's the way that a lot of us would like to approach our relationship to God. You know, the problem is, you know, we envision ourselves bringing God to the bargaining table when He has said all He is going to say on the matter of what is right and wrong and how we are saved, and it's up to us to respond, so we just invent responses for ourselves. Yeah, and yeah, that's... we import the way we often use these terms into the text. Again, Paul's emphasis is on work. Work the salvation that you have is kind of the idea. Work and work it how? What's the rest? What's the modifier? With fear and trembling. Okay, go ahead, Shane, and we'll talk about the modifier.
Well, if someone's talking about let's go to the gym and work out, you know, the understanding there is we're going to the gym, we're going to put effort, we're going to do some things, we're going to lift some weights, we're going to exercise, there's going to be effort put forth. Nobody says, let's go to the gym and work out, and then they go and they have a conversation with the weights about, you know, whether or not, you know, I tell you, if I lift you one time, you're going to give me credit for two. You know, we don't, so that same phrase, work out, in the context, you know, they changed the meaning of it here, but I think it means the same thing. I mean, it's the effort that you have to put into it, and you have to do it the right way.
Okay. All right. Mark?
From the way this is framed, it seems like Paul is saying the things you do according to God's will, which you make your own, are for His good pleasure, and they're not because I'm there to watch you.
Right.
You carry on. What you will and work are really what God intends for, has planned for you to do, and you're doing it for His good pleasure.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great summary, yes. Yes. Somebody else? Wayne?
I've had a number of discussions with some denominational friends who seem to think that faith only is all you need. Mm-hmm. They miss out on what James had to say about faith and work. But the, as I said, the word work itself, that's not in the vocabulary. They hate to hear that. And so they automatically discount it as any kind of effort on our part that we need to put forth. And they, what they're doing really is discounting what God has required of all of those who come to Him. We must take His word and obey it. And in obedience, that they just hate that word.
Yeah. Very good. Well, it's not good, but it's a good observation. Yeah. Okay. All right. This really isn't that hard. Mark's summary of the verses is well said. Paul's not there. Paul hasn't been there for some time. Paul's in a situation that, at least from the outside, looks really uncertain right now. If Paul is removed from the picture, does that remove the accountability that the Philippians have to do what's right? No.
Okay.
And they've been carrying on with that obedience, even though Paul hasn't been present with them. His, as he will put it later, being poured out as a drink offering shouldn't change that either. Okay, so there's that. With fear and trembling. We emphasize this a lot. Sometimes we overemphasize it. In both Old and New Testaments, the word fear is used many, many times to describe the response of godly people to God. And it is the ordinary word for fear that is often used. But we understand that it is used in a way that can, where the emphasis is on reverence and respect and awe. Not that the emphasis is on abject terror. And yet at the same time, there's an understanding that God should be inspiring abject terror in those who are disobedient to Him. Old Testament makes that abundantly clear. So fear's a loaded word in that respect. But working out with fear and trembling, which is, again, far from what we desire. We don't like accountability to higher authority. I think probably people in ancient times had less trouble with that than we do. And certainly people in ancient Roman culture probably had less trouble with it than people in the United States of America in pretty much any generation have. You know, we just generally, we don't like authority. And the idea of being fearful and reverent toward any authority, even God's, really chafes a lot of people. Even people who claim to be believers. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Paul lays an obligation on them. He lays a sense of duty, not just on them, but on us. Do it whether I'm, you did it when I was there. You keep doing it even in my absence. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. For, verse 13, it is God who is at work in you, both to will and to work for His good pleasure. Everything consistent with the will of God that they do can be said to be God willing and working through them. Does that make sense? Do we see it that way? Have we learned to see that? When I am doing what God asks me and tells me to do, then that really is God working through me. Okay? It's precisely what it is. Wayne?
I was having a Bible discussion with Jeff, a denominational preacher once, and I was quite young, about 20 years old. But I mentioned to him and quoted to him, really, Hebrews 5:8-9, about Jesus, even though he were a son, that he learned obedience by the things that he suffered, and having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation. And this man was so angry and furious with me. He shouted at me and said, I don't have to obey anybody. And I very frankly told him, no, you don't. You deny and go to hell if you're determined to. God is not going to stop you. He beat his chest with his fist, and he said, I'll take what I feel right here over a stack of Bibles. That is so, what do you call that? I mean, how do you...
How do you charitably describe that is what I'm trying to think. Yeah.
It's not, it's unrational. Yeah. I mean, it's so... That's right. I mean, you can't deal or work with someone with that kind of a thinking.
All right. Again, what Paul says here is not, I don't think, very difficult to understand. And yet, as we've seen from a couple of different perspectives, it raises things that we have trouble with. Human beings have trouble with. So maybe it is the case that people at Philippi in the first century struggled with some of these things too. He's going to talk about what it looks like to work out our salvation with fear and trembling. He's already said some of those things. He's going to talk about a few more specifics. And remember that Paul doesn't do this in Philippians to quite the degree of organization that he does in some other letters like Ephesians. But a lot of times, Paul's approach will be to talk about who God is and what God has done for us. And set forth, sometimes in just beautiful terms, what God in Christ has done for us, and then turn the discussion to what we are called on to do in response to that. The Ephesian letter pretty neatly divides up like that. Paul spends the first couple of chapters talking about what God has done for us, and then turns attention to what are our lives supposed to reflect given that. What does it look like when we respond properly to that? This is, in Philippians, Paul's way of doing kind of the same thing. Doug, do you have a hand up, somebody? Go ahead. Yeah.
I was going to say that we think we have a choice in what our work should be. That's eliminated by verse 13.
Okay. Yeah.
And it says we do His goodwill and His pleasure, not what we want. So it's not working out what I want to do. When we work out our salvation, it's doing what God wants.
Right. Right. And if we center it on that understanding, it prevents, I think, all the misuses of this passage or the wrong approaches to it that we've talked about this morning. I didn't mean to talk about it quite that much, but it is. You'll hear this, and you'll hear this very much like Shane talked about Matthew 7:1, and there's some other ones. The people will throw up as a defense mechanism, basically to prevent themselves from having to think seriously about what the gospel is calling on them to do. Well, you do your thing and I'll do mine. Work out your own salvation and fear. So the next time somebody throws that one at you, you can stop them and say, well, no, wait a minute. Let's look at what Paul's actually saying here in Philippians 2:12-13. It's not that. And maybe you can help somebody in that respect. So verse 14, we just want to pass over verse 14. I don't like verse 14. Do you like verse 14? Do all things without what?
Grumbling
and disputing. All right. Why does Paul need to focus on this with the Philippians? I don't know. Had Paul gotten word that there was some grumbling and disputing among them, or is it just more likely that all of us struggle with this? So let's talk about the words Paul uses here are interesting. I can't even pronounce them in Greek, but grumbling most of the time conveys what we would call murmuring, muttering. Thayer defined it as a secret displeasure not openly avowed. Now, it's not always silent or said to oneself, because there are a couple of passages that use this word to describe what was clearly an open complaint. But the general sense of the word is when I'm grumbling to myself or grumbling about something privately. Now, again, exception, Shane, I'll come back to your comment in just a minute. A couple of exceptions in Acts chapter 6, when it says, a complaint arose in the church of Jerusalem. This is the word that's used. Well, I'm sure there was a lot of grumbling in private about it, but that's a pretty public complaint that arises. So sometimes it's used in that sense too. Disputing is a word that means arguing or disputing. It's the word James uses in James chapter 2, verse 4. Paul uses it in 1 Timothy 2, verse 8.
So it pops up a couple of other times in the New Testament. Put those together, and you've got a pretty wide range of expressions of ill content, if you will. Shane, go ahead. If you remember what you were going to say.
Yeah, sometimes I forget. What he's describing here, I've seen this in the workplace, and it's a cancerous situation where if you have one person, if one person gets disgruntled, and then they start murmuring to somebody else, well, hey, what do you think about this? I'm not certain. I think that's right. And there are people in this world that will do this to try to get a following, or at least get people to agree with them and get enough momentum where they can start disrupting the operations. And in a body of God's people, there's no place for that. We are all supposed to be here together in love, in one mind, and working together for the common goal of heaven. And there's no place for someone to be disgruntled and trying to disrupt the congregation. It will split a congregation. I've seen it happen before.
Sure. Yeah, and it works the same way. Yeah, right.
I think it helps clarify too that fear and trembling. We have this reverence about how we act and obey. So then we understand it's God's will working through us. And it means our attitude has to be right. You can't just decide I'm obeying, but my attitude secretly is one of, oh, I can't believe I have to do this or whatever. That's not working out your salvation with fear and trembling. That's complaining about what you have to do. Okay. And so it just kind of helps clarify that it's not just that obedience. It is there's more to it than that.
Okay. Excellent point. Even if we're not trying to get a following, like Shane said, why do we have trouble with this? Because I know most of us, to some degree, we do. When things are not the way we want them to be, what do? We complain about it.
Misery loves company.
Okay. And we may, depending on the circumstances, we may not use the second word, dispute or argue about it. We may not voice it publicly. But we will complain about it if somebody is willing to listen to us complain about it. And that may be our spouse, that may be a close friend, maybe somebody else. Why? Why is this hard for us?
I hearken to the Israelites in the wilderness. They just complained about everything the entire time. And I'm amazed that it took Moses as long as it did to lose his temper with them for all the grumbling that was constant. Constant. He brought us out here to die. Mm-hmm. And it was like they thought they had the right to complain in order to get something that they thought they needed. Just terrible.
Sure. So go ahead, Ryan.
I don't want to say it's human nature, because I don't want to say that God made us complainers, but I do think it's probably a lack of thankfulness is often the case. And whatever you have to do, not being thankful about whatever else is going on in your life that's good, leads to grumbling. It can be, I don't like doing this, I don't like the way you're asking me to do this, or we can just say, I'm thankful that I can serve, I'm thankful that I can do this. And those seem to be, it's hard to be thankful and complain at the same time.
It is. And Paul later on will talk about thankfulness primarily as an antidote to worry and anxiety, but it's also a good antidote to complaining. Yeah. And Paul gives a reason for it that's built into the text here. I don't think it's the only reason, but he says, do all things without grumbling or disputing, so that you will do what in verse 15? Okay. So that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach. What does that suggest?
Well,
Do everything without grumbling and complaining and disputing and whining, so that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent.
Suggests that grumblers aren't blameless.
Okay. That should be obvious, but I'm glad you said it. Yeah, it suggests that grumblers are not blameless. It may also point to the fact that people around us are watching and observing our conduct and the way we respond to the duties we're given by God, so that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent. Blameless is a word that means deserving no censure. Remember when we talked, when we were in Timothy and Titus, we looked at the qualifications of overseers in the local church. Both 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 used pretty much at the beginning of that set of qualifications, this word blameless. It's not this same word that Paul uses here. It's a different word in Timothy. It's a different word still in Titus. But they all convey pretty much the same idea. Not that somebody is flawless, but that somebody has the kind of character that you can't make charges of sin or inappropriate conduct stick. One against whom censure or blame cannot be brought. And notice, Paul says that this is not just for elders. Paul says, I want all of you to prove yourselves to be blameless. Innocent is a word that technically means pure. It's a word you would use like, you don't want your gold mixed with a whole bunch of other metal alloys. You want it to be pure. You don't want your wine to be watered down. You want it to be pure. Matt? That is so important. Yeah. Well said. Yep.
I was going to say, throughout these studies, I call it kingdom teaching because it flips our thinking on its head, because the normal way that the world would go about this, it's easy to complain. It's easy to do this. It's easy to think about self. It's hard to think about others. So Paul does he's giving us a different mindset or that we should approach, because we are a part of the kingdom. We should have a different than the rest of the world. A truly blessed people. We understand the biggest picture of it all. We have forgiveness of sins. We have a relationship with God that the rest of the world does not have. And that in and of itself should provide this idea of, we go about our days, we go about our lives, in a different mindset, a different perspective than the rest of the world would drag you down into.
Okay. Very good. Anthony?
Mindset of grumbling and disputing is a mind that's going, that's looking either to the past or the present, not looking to the future, as we're called to do. And also when it says to prove yourself blameless and innocent, and so that you will appear as a light in the world, I've, to my shame, I've done my fair share of complaining at my job, but there was one teacher that I didn't talk to often, but when I did, I knew she was a Christian, and I would go to encourage her because I knew she was having a hard time. And she, one day, one of these past few weeks, said, "I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you don't let this stuff get to you." And she said, "I wish I could be like you." And again, that's not because I didn't do those things in my own time, but when you show yourself to be different, just as these gentlemen have been mentioning, the people will seek you out. And what he's calling is not just to, you know, improve yourself, but improve the image of what you're showing to other people, because they will seek that out. That's what they're looking for, whether they know it or not.
Very good. Before we talk a little more about verse 15, I'll say it should go without saying, but we're going to say it anyway. When there's a problem that needs to be addressed, we need to address it. When things, for example, in the local church, you know, when there are problems in a local church, this doesn't mean I just need to, just entirely keep silent about it. If it's something that's a threat to the church or a threat to someone's spiritual health, I can do that, but I can address that, you know, I can address that with the elders, for instance, without it being complaining and grumbling. I think when Acts chapter 6 says a complaint arose in the church, that doesn't mean those people were doing something wrong by raising that complaint necessarily. There was a legitimate need that was being overlooked, and it needed to be corrected. And as soon as the apostles became aware of the situation, they prescribed what the congregation could do to correct it, and the situation was resolved. Life is never going to be free from conflicts, and Paul, I don't think, is asking us just to ignore those things. But the comments that have been made, I think, are very good. Am I going to adopt an attitude and a mindset and a lifestyle that approaches every day with, you know, where I'm going to complain about everything that I don't like, complain about everything that doesn't go my way? And even after I have tried, you know, when I've taken the steps to resolve it in the right way, am I going to just keep on griping about it just because it gives me an outlet to vent my emotions or whatever it is? Ryan, you said a minute ago, we don't like to say that's human nature. I don't mind saying it's human nature as long as we understand it's something acquired. Okay? It becomes second nature to us really early in life to complain when we're not getting our way. Paul says kingdom citizens don't do that. And they especially don't do that when it comes to their citizenship in the kingdom and the things that go with it. Shane?
Well, Mike Williamson, in the last couple of Bible studies, made a point about sin being selfish act. And that's really, and it's been touched on here already, it's that attitude of self. You know, instead of having that servant's mentality, Jesus said that to his apostles that people would know that they're his servants because they serve one another. Jesus washed their feet, which was completely beneath even any of them in their society. It was something that went outside the bounds of what someone would say, "Well, I don't have to do that. I'm not a feet washer. That's beneath me." Our service to one another and to mankind is selfless, or should be selfless if it's done properly, because the attitude here is it's not about us. We have a Father that loves us. He sent His Son to die for us, and we owe a debt that we cannot pay, and all we can do is our best to serve in the best manner that we can to thankfulness for that gift. And it's not about us. We don't get a say in the matter. And if we're concerned about our say in the matter, then we don't have the right attitude.
Since you brought up service to others, one of the only other passages that uses this first word is 1 Peter 4, verse 9, where he says, be hospitable to one another without complaint. And sometimes even in an act of service such as that, we can find a cause for complaining. Peter says, don't do that. Paul says, do these things so that you may be blameless, prove yourselves blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach. That's the word you would use for an unblemished sacrificial animal, above reproach here. Children of God, unblemished, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation among whom you appear as lights in the world. Everybody know what scoliosis is? It's a deformity where the spine. The word Paul uses for crooked is the Greek word we get that from. It's scolios. Perverse means to distort, to turn aside. When Paul says we live in, it wasn't just the Philippians, we do too, live in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, what he's telling us is that there's a standard that most people have deviated from. There's a base of right that most people have departed from. Things are not the way they ought to be in most people's lives. It's crooked and perverse, this generation in which they live. That's the world around you. It's in the air you breathe. And what was true for them is true for us. Maybe not in all exactly the same ways, but it is. And he says, you are children of God in the midst of that. And in the midst of that, you appear as lights in the world. What does that remind you of? First of all, it reminds us of Jesus in Matthew 5. You are the light of the world. It reminds us of the song that so many of us learned, this little Christian light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Paul's talking about that. You appear as stars in the universe, some of our translations say. That word lights is the word that ordinary people would have used to describe the stars in the sky, too. You stand out. You are different. You're supposed to be different. Several of the comments y'all have made this morning highlight that. Just in one aspect, if I approach my day without a lot of complaining and grumbling, that's going to mark me off as different from a lot of people. And folks are going to notice that. On the other hand, to the point Matt made earlier, it's going to harm my witness for the gospel if people know me as a chronic complainer, and then I'm trying to talk to them about this salvation in Christ and this way of living that's supposed to be the greatest thing in the world, and yet all I ever do is complain all the time. That won't make sense to them. Paul says, do these things and more, so that you will prove yourselves blameless and innocent children of God above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation among whom you appear as lights in the world. We're going to have to leave it there, so we're going to talk about the rest of this chapter, starting with kind of in the middle of this paragraph. We're going to talk about that Wednesday night. Got a few more things that Paul says about the Philippians in particular. And then he's going to turn attention to a couple of people that are in his immediate circle and the Philippians' immediate circle, Timothy and Epaphroditus. And we're going to, even though Paul inserts these rather personal situations into this letter, they still have something to teach us. We still have something to learn from it. So we're going to talk about that Wednesday night. Appreciate all your good comments this morning. Thank you.